Ooh. So my man at the back's going to keep my levels good because I tend to boom a little. So welcome to AZR 225. For those of you who have arrived a little bit late, tweet this session with hash code AZR 225 throughout, and at the end I'm going to pick one and we might give you a white Nokia Lumia 710. So this session's about a Microsoft sample application that we're about to ship called the Stock Trader sample application. Who's seen the Stock Trader sample application? The gentleman in the front in the yellow striped shirt here certainly has. Seen the Stock Trader application a few times. It's been around a while. It hails from the time when Java was a competitive platform. Who remembers those days? There we go. Right, so, and actually it started out life as a Java sample application. It's been ported across to .NET, and we are about to ship version 6 of the Stock Trader sample application. And we like to think that it's the best Stock Trader sample application yet. So, some of the things we've done with version 6 is we've moved it up into Windows Azure. And we have actually optimized it for Windows Azure. So I'm going to talk to you a bit about how we've done that today, how we take advantage of the service bus, data tier scale out using SQL Azure Federations. And then we've also built some new front ends for it. So we built an HTML5 front end using MVC 4.0. We've also built a Windows 8 modern UI front end. We've built an Android app, iPhone app, Windows Phone app. And certainly the Windows 8, Windows Phone, iPhone, and Android have a significant shared code base. Same source code files compiled into all four of those platforms. So we're going to talk a bit about how we did that as well. This is a 200-level session, which means it's less about me showing you code and more about me yakety-yakking and waving my arms and showing you some pretty pictures. So if you want to see lots of code, this is not the place to be. I promise there will be no JavaScript shown in this session. Haven't touched JavaScript since about 1999. I don't have a great desire to go and do it anytime soon. Unpopular as that may make me. So, we are going to go through and talk a bit about some of the approaches and patterns for moving a legacy app up into Windows Azure. So both what we call the lift and shift pattern, which is really throw it up in the cloud, and how we then take that and optimize it for Windows Azure. And some of that is going to involve how we go about using SQL Azure Federations. Anyone using Federations already? No one. Awesome. We're all going to learn something new, and if you want to really deep dive on Federations, I've got another session first thing tomorrow morning. We're going to see some interesting approaches for using the Windows Azure Service Bus, and then some approaches for how we can build these cross-platform mobile front ends. So in terms of building some cross-platform mobile apps, anyone doing it at the moment? Cross-platform mobile apps? What are you guys using? Mono? Cool. So we are going to talk about using Mono. Anyone using HTML5 plus PhoneGap? Yep, a few people doing that. So we are talking about the Mono approach. And we'll actually talk about some of the pros and cons of HTML5 versus Mono and so forth. And we'll finish up talking a bit about some of the ways that we can actually consume the .NET service bus from within that Mono code. So effectively I've got a really nice massive scale out with a shared client code set mechanism for delivering messages out to these various platforms. So as I said before, Stock Trader's been around a while. Stock Trader was originally a Java sample app, and basically it is a demonstration app that simulates a stock broking, stock trading platform. It was originally written to provide a demonstration of massive application throughput, and we have tried to stay true to that. So we are actually running a whole bunch of benchmarks at the moment, including benchmarking how this thing performs when we scale it out to almost 100 SQL Azure Database Federation members. So we are seeing some pretty interesting throughput numbers there, and so we hope that once we've published the sample app, we're going to be able to publish some of those benchmark numbers as well. So in terms of what it is, it's an end-tier application, and it's built with .NET code. against a SQL Server database. So you can pick it up and run it as you have been able to for about 10 years as an on-premise application. But we have more recently been doing some work to configure it so that it can be deployed into Windows Azure. It can now be deployed into Windows Azure. And again, it's designed as a benchmarkable application. You will, when you open up the code, see that it is an evolution. So you'll find some stuff that has literally been around since the days of .NET 1.0. You'll also see some stuff that is, you know, the very latest in .NET. So what does it look like? So in an on-premise mode, we basically have the StockTrader web application, and that is the primary user interface for on-premise mode for accessing the application. That talks to a middle tier called the StockTrader Business Services layer, and that Business Services layer communicates both directly with the SQL Server database and also with a thing called the StockTrader Order Processing Service. So when you're working in on-prem mode, and we actually have a bunch of scripts to help do this, we have scripts and tooling to show you how you can configure this in private cloud mode and easily scale it out by scaling these various tiers inside your private cloud. So what we then did is we thought, okay, we want to get this working in Windows Azure. So the first thing you do if you're going to move an application to Windows Azure is effectively look at what we call a lift and shift pattern. The lift and shift pattern is basically lift up what we've got on-premise and throw it in the cloud. Don't do a whole lot of code rewrite to optimize it to work with the cloud platform. And actually, this, you know, an application that is a classic sort of three-tier, scale-every-tier application model is actually pretty easy to lift and shift into Windows Azure, right? Because you have got stateless tiers in both your web tier and your middle tier. Right, so we basically lifted up those three components of the application that run on-premise, moved them into Azure Web Roles and an Azure Worker Role, and then we wire them up. So we wire them up slightly differently in that we've removed MSMQ, which was a core component of the on-premise model, and instead we use WCF with both HTTP and TCP transport protocols. And the database has been moved into SQL Azure, and that really is the one bit that we, with the lift and shift model, we haven't really optimized. And, you know, that is, in this model, sort of the key point where we're going to run into problems, because that's the throttle point, right? That's the point where we're going to choke. You know, a SQL Azure database has a limited level of throughput, and it also has a non-deterministic level of throughput. And what I mean by that is it has a thing called the query throttle, and the query throttle will effectively throttle your database connectivity based on the load that happens to be running against the database server on which your database actually lives. And the reason it's non-deterministic is it's not just your load that determines when the throttle kicks in. It's the load of every other database that happens to be on that same shared database server. So when you're thinking about building applications out in the cloud, Windows Azure plus SQL Azure, there are some very important considerations you have to think about. The first is that if you expect to have any sort of significant load, you should always plan on building to scale out from the outset. If you think you're going to get away with running on a single SQL Azure instance, at the moment, you know, that probably tops out at, thousands of transactions per second. So, for StockTrader V6, obviously we've done our lift and shift. What else do we want to do? So the first thing we want to do is we wanted to try and split out our exchange and brokerage aspects, because we wanted to show how we can model better the idea of a real stock exchange and multiple brokerages accessing that, and how we could use the .NET service bus to decouple those multiple brokerages from the exchange. So we're going to have a look at how we do that a bit later on. The next thing is we had to scale that data tier. Right? So we had to go from using a single SQL Azure database to running multiple SQL Azure databases using the SQL Azure Federations technology. And Federations is basically a natively supported function inside SQL Azure that implements the database sharding pattern. right? So effectively horizontal scale out by sharding your database. Think of it like horizontal partitioning. Anyone done some database sharding work before? One person? So it's a common pattern for scaling out databases. And then we wanted to build some rich user experiences. We wanted to have a mobile experience that targeted all of the major platforms, so iOS, Android, Windows Phone, and we wanted to have an HTML5 plus JavaScript front end and a modern UI Windows 8 front end. So what did we do there? The first thing we did is we split the database out. So it was working with a single database. We've chopped that database in half. And we've made that database, each of those databases, we've enabled federation. So we basically federate and shard those databases out across multiple instances. The nice thing about the federations technology is that we can then write our application so that it doesn't need to worry about the number of shards that we actually have. So whether we have 2 shards or whether we have 200 shards, our application code is exactly the same. But we have had to make some reasonably major rewrites of our application code to support that sharding pattern. We then picked up pretty much the same sort of topology of our roles, but we've done some additional work to configure the communications, right? So we have got WCF from our web app into our business services layer. But then the way that we communicate between our business services layer and our order processing services, we now use the .NET service bus. And we use what's called brokered messaging. And brokered messaging basically means that we effectively use queues, topics, and subscriptions to push messages in and out. So when the stock trader business service wants to place an order, it drops that order onto a queue. That queued message is picked up by the stock trader order processing service. It's processed, and then confirmation of that sale is published out to a topic, and our business service then subscribes to that topic. What that lets us do is we can easily add additional business services without having to rewrite any application code. We add the additional business service, it just places its orders into the queue, and then it creates a subscription to receive back the purchase confirmation messages off the various topics. And then we scale out as we have done before by scaling the web roles and the worker roles. Then to build the mobile front end, we've built out sort of true mobile apps using Mono for iOS and Android. We then use the native Windows Phone tools to build a .NET-based app for Windows Phone, and we've then used .NET to build a WinRT app for Windows 8. All four of those platforms share significant amounts of code. And certainly all of the code, the low-level plumbing code that does the communications back and forth to the server, is all shared across all of those platforms. So we expose out a RESTful endpoint and a token service for our clients to be able to communicate to and from the business services to check their orders, to get their portfolios and so forth. And then we wanted to show how we can do large-scale beyond push messaging. So the problem with sort of your typical application push messaging, if you're familiar with push messages out to the various mobile platforms, is it's quite non-deterministic in terms of exactly when those messages get through. So we wanted to show a slightly more deterministic approach, and that was to show a scale-out fashion for our clients to be able to poll up to the service to get streaming news. And again, the way we've done that is we've used the .NET service bus, once again with topics and subscriptions, to build a mechanism that we can offload that client polling from our web roles onto the service bus, and instead of client polling our web roles, the clients poll the service bus. And we'll talk a bit about how we've done that as well. So, a super quick demo of StockTrader. I'm not going to show it to you in any great detail. I was going to show you the Android client, and I thought to myself, I'll be a clever bugger, and I'll just do a hard reset on my Android device, so I've got a nice, clean device to install my application onto. What do you know? Android 2.2, LG Optimus, crap, nasty device, honestly. on Virgin Mobile in the US, hard reset, guess what? You cannot change the date and time on this. Only works if it's automatically updating the date and time from the carrier. Doesn't work in Australia. Put it in the bin, you piece of crap. So, I'm not showing you the Android experience today, because I cannot install any applications to that, because I can't change the time. This is truly an example that if you work hard enough at dropping your bill of materials cost, you can produce a really, really terrible smart device. But it's $25 a month for unlimited data, unlimited text, 200 minutes in the States. So if you're a regular traveller to the States, highly recommend it. So, on that note, let me jump in and just grab a demo link here. So this is the Stock Trader HTML5 and JavaScript front end, as long as my network works. And again, you know, it's the user experience designed by developers, so it hasn't got some of that fit and finish. It's a super simple example of building a stock exchange type applications. Users have portfolios, holdings, so forth. They can buy, they can sell, they can search and get quotes. In terms of an actual application, it's not got a lot of functionality, but it does show all of those key things that you'd want to have in sort of your three-tier application, including now communication down onto these rich clients. So we've also got a Windows 8 version. And I'm going to run that up. And we're going to come back and actually drill on the code on the Windows 8 version a little bit later on. So it's a true modern UI. And for those of you who noticed, that HTML1 is actually live on the web, so you can go grab it now. And in fact, the app is in the Android App Store. So feel free, who's got an Android phone, you just pulled it up now. It's installing now. So fair dinkum, it's legit, right? It's just that this is a piece of turd. So this is the Stock Trader application in the modern UI. It is absolutely hip to be square. Probably needs a little bit more yellow. And again, there's sort of shared code, right, between this iPhone, Android, Windows phone. We've got semantic zoom. We can pick it up and we can pin it to the side and it'll, rework the UI. And we're going to give you all this code in the next sort of couple of weeks, so you're able to download and play to your heart's content. We've got search integration. So, for example, I could search for stock 111. Pull up a quote for that, app bar, buy some stock, quite a nice little dialogue there. Yep, I want to buy. And so you'll see that actually that buy order's been placed. It's gone through the business service layer, it's gone to the order processing service has responded to the business service layer, and then I've got that result that the order's been finished back down onto my client application. So that is the super quick lap around Stock Trader. You got that Android app up yet? Hey? Too busy paying attention to the presentation. Still downloading. So, for Stock Trader version 5, it's up stocktrader.cloudapp.net at the moment. We basically move to being an Azure-compatible application. Lift and Shift gives you an Azure-compatible application. If you think you are going to get any level of load, then you need to make sure that you are Azure-optimized. What does that mean? It means that we need to be able to scale our application and web tier. That means that we really need to have a stateless application and web tier. All right? That lets us run that out across multiple instances in our web and worker roles. We really need to scale out the database tier. Now, this applies regardless of whether we're going to use SQL Azure or if we're going to use SQL Server running in a Windows Azure VM. Right? So that's effectively the PaaS offering versus the IaaS offering. If you ever think you're going to be running at web scale with a relational database backend, you need to plan to scale that out if you're going to use a cloud environment. And the reason for that is pretty simple. You just cannot buy very big machines in cloud computing providers. Yes, you can buy some big ones for Amazon. Who does some stuff with Amazon? Big databases in Amazon, running any quad XLs, right? That's like peachy, except the I.O. is awful. And of course, it's a database, and I.O. is everything for a database. I'm convinced that the popularity of NoSQL data stores is largely driven by the fact that it's very hard to run a relational database at scale in the cloud. I.O. is everything, and it is hard to do regardless of whether you're using Microsoft, Amazon, Rackspace, anybody. And then a bunch of services are not going to be supported. So, for example, it's very hard to do distributed transactions in Windows Azure. Right? It's pretty much impossible without using the IaaS offering. Certainly SQL Azure will not enlist to a distributed transaction managed by the DTC. So you're going to need to strip out. If you're using things like, you know, DTC managed transactions with MSMQ and SQL Server, you're going to need to go and rip and rework that significantly. So that's sort of the changes you're going to need to make from what you're probably running on-premise. And then you've got some opportunities to further optimize. And some of those are around the service bus for messaging. Right? So using the service bus for your messaging allows you to offload all of that messaging infrastructure into another set of servers that you don't have to worry about. And then the same thing for using that service bus to offload polling situations. So as we increasingly move towards having these client applications, be they sort of real client applications or rich HTML applications using WebSockets, using SignalR, those are polling type patterns, right? And they are going to load up your web roles. There is the potential to use the service bus to offload that as well. So let's talk about the scale-out data tier. So SQL Azure, who's familiar with SQL Azure? Few people. Who's not? Probably about 50-50, yeah? So SQL Azure is basically Microsoft SQL Server running up in Windows Azure, and you don't need to worry at all about the operating system, right? You rock up, you give them your credit card, and you say, I want a SQL Server database, and then wham, bam, thank you, ma'am, you connect on port 1433 with SQL Server Management Studio, and you've got a database. All right? So, no worrying about the operating system, no installing bloody SQL Server, just works. Got a whole bunch of other benefits. The first is it's got what we call high availability built in. What I mean by that is your SQL Azure database is actually three SQL Server databases spread across the Microsoft data center. And they are kept in transactional consistency. So anytime you make a write into one of those databases, right, it ensures that that transaction is committed across those replicas for you. So you have a full high availability database, and SQL Azure starts at $5 a month. Anybody think they could do a high availability on-premise SQL Server database at $5 a month? No. Probably add 2 to 3 zeros, I suspect. All right, so quite interesting in that regard. And it is largely just SQL Server. All right? Now, there are some things you can't do. There's not a lot of physical optimization you can do, all right, because you just got the database. But it is largely, you know, it's TDS compatible, so you just use your existing tools. You're just using T-SQL to work with it. Some of the challenges. So the first challenge is that it's quite limited in terms of its scale-up. Right? So you can't say, I want to run, you know, a machine with 128 gigs of RAM. Right? Because 128 gigs of RAM is cheap as chips these days. Right? On-premise database server, you throw 100... Who's got the most RAM of anybody's database server in the room? Who's got more than 100 gigs in their database server? Really? One person at the back, right? 192 gigs in his database server. It's cheap as chips, eh? What? On your dev box. He's got 192 gigs. Shit. I got 32 gigs on my dev laptop. Who's got 32 gigs on their dev laptop? Yeah, a couple of people, right? It's just so cheap these days. So, limited scale, we just can't do that in SQL Azure, right? So, we need to think about how we scale out. Also has that thing called the query throttle, right? That means that those copies of your database in the data center, one of them is called the primary replica, all right? So that primary replica is where you're going first, where your transactions go first, and they get quorum committed to the other replicas. Based on the amount of load on the box that houses that copy, you may or may not occasionally get throttled. Throttle basically just means it takes your database connection, whacks it, and says try again later. Now, try again later is usually a couple of hundred milliseconds. Right? And if that doesn't work, try 500 milliseconds. Okay, try 2,000 milliseconds. And once it gets beyond that, it's probably going to kill the whole replica, point you at one of the other replicas, and spin up a new one. All right? So you need to, one, understand that that could happen. Two, deal with those disconnections. Right? Because disconnections happen for a bunch of reasons. Disconnections happen when the throttle kicks in. Disconnections happen if your primary replica fails. If your primary replica fails, we're going to whack the connection. Right? We're going to make another copy of the primary, and you're going to reconnect. We're going to route you through to the other copy, and Bob's your auntie's living lover, off you go again. Right? And then the last reason is if you're going to use federations are kind of cool, right? So we can chop that database up. We can actually chop our database up under transactional load. So we can be hammering the crap out of the database, and we can say split it in two, and it'll split it in two, all the while we're throwing load at this database, right? And then once it's ready for us to change, it's going to whack the connection, we reconnect, and we're being routed at those two copies again. At no point do we lose any of our transactions, right? The transaction we might be halfway through when we get whacked, yeah, that's going to get rolled back properly. But that's kind of neat, right? I've never seen that sort of capability before in a shard out pattern, right? The ability to effectively shard under transactional load. And there's currently no point in time backup. That is coming. It's currently in technical preview. So if you're going to use SQL Azure for your large-scale applications, you must think about how you scale out your data tier. Right? If you're going to have any sort of load, you've got to think about how you scale out your data tier. Regardless, you need to make sure you've implemented that elegant retry reconnection pattern. We have a class that we call diehard.cs, and diehard.cs basically is our little class for going back and trying and trying and trying and trying again when it gets whacked. Who's using SQL Azure? You got a diehard.cs? No? Who's just doing plain old same code as you use on-prem? Yeah? So you need to have a look at that, folks. And also, the same thing applies if you're going to use SQL Server 2012 on-premise with the always-on functionality. All right? So always-on is basically some of the cloud technology pulled back into on-prem. All right? So always-on works in a similar fashion to the way the high availability works for SQL Azure. So again, if you're going to use always-on, make sure you've got that robust retry logic in there. So up to version 5, the stock trader schema looks something like this. Right? We basically had our account. We had orders and holdings, and then we had quotes. So what we did is we split that database in two. So we effectively had an account database and a quote database, and then we federated those. So we basically horizontally partitioned those databases. So we horizontally partition the account database by user ID. What that means is that our account database is actually made up of multiple databases, and each of those database instances contains a range of account user IDs. Right? And what it means is that we can basically keep chopping that up into smaller and smaller bits. The smallest bit that we can have on a single database is what? One user. Right, basically all the data for one user on a single database. So when we do the sort of the scratch and sniff test and go, okay, do I think one user is going to be able to overwhelm a SQL database? Probably not. Good. We've taken an appropriate sort of shard out pattern there. Then for the quote database, what we've done there is we have federated using the quote symbol. So basically using the ticker symbol. Right, so that means that the smallest sort of chopping down is what? Quotes for a single company. Right? Now, the only time I possibly think we could overwhelm that is the short sellers tomorrow morning shorting the company that launched their new mobile device this morning. Because I'm going short tomorrow morning because it hasn't rocked my socks off. So, Your federation key. So your federation key is basically the key that we're going to use to chop up our database, right? So to effectively define what those horizontal partitions are. Can be an int, a GUID, or a var binary. So var binary is quite nice because it means that potentially we can use a federation key that's up to 900 bytes in size. When we moved StockTrader, we had a bit of a problem, and that was that we had varchar in our application for our user ID. That wasn't much good to us, so what we did is we simply converted that to var binary in our app layer. You will typically, and again, come to my session tomorrow morning for a whole lot of discussion on this slide. I've probably got about 10 slide expansion on this. You'll typically want to use unique identifier, and I'll keep my powder dry for tomorrow as to exactly why you do that. Primary keys. So this was built back in sort of the early 2000s. Lots and lots of int identity columns. Those are not supported across federations. Who can think of why they wouldn't be supported across federations? Keeping them in sync, right? You've got all these databases. Oh, I'm going to have an auto number. Okay, how are we going to run the auto number? We'll just go to this sort of central point and we'll just get the next number. Okay, so we're 200 databases wide, each doing 2,000 transactions per second. We go into your little database there to go and get an auto number. That is a scalability anti-pattern, folks. So, can't use identity columns. So what we did is we picked those up and we actually moved them across to unique identifier. But that did mean that we had to flow the whole lot through the rest of our application. So we basically use a string inside the service layer, and then in some parts of our application we actually use native GUIDs. In other parts of our application we actually cast it out to a big int, right? So that works pretty well. Okay, so when we move to federations, we need to be able to identify the federation member we want to use from our application layer. So what we do is when we establish our connection to the database, we use this statement called use federation as we connect, and that uses what we call data-dependent routing to connect us to the appropriate federation member. So if we're going to go and start making orders for user ID UID-5, we want to use federation passing in the var binary version of the string UID-5, and that's going to route our connection and make sure that we connect to the appropriate member, wherever that member happens to be, right? Because when we want to do a split, the database that user sits in is going to change, right? So we don't need to know about the underlying structure of all of those databases. We just need to say, give me the database for UID-5, and SQL Azure is going to understand exactly which database instance to actually route your connection to. Mentioned before, we have to have that retry logic because we're going to potentially split under transactional load. As we get split, we get disconnected. So I'll show you roughly what sort of that federation routing looks like. So it's pretty simple. We just have some const strings up here. So we use a statement called use federation, and we pass in the federation key that the federation we're using, right? So if we're using the user federation, user ID equals and the key value that we want to connect to. That's going to connect us to the right database instance. And then we pass in something that says whether or not we want filtering turned on. And what filtering does is it's effectively a protection measure that means that we can only deal with data relating to that user. So, for example, if we connect to a federation member that's got the data for 500 users in it, but we've passed in UID-5, we can only work with the data for UID-5 in that case. And again, we'll drill into that in a bit more detail tomorrow. And then we basically have some tools here. And you'll quite like to pick up this code because it gives you quite an elegant way of selecting federation members, because we actually keep a track of what was the last federation that we were trying to use. so that we don't have to unnecessarily go and switch if we try and use the same federation key again. Because it can be, at the moment, it's a little bit of a performance hit every time you switch a federation member. There are some challenges around connection pooling. That's going to improve in the next few months. So the next thing that's hard with federations is what we call fan-out queries. And so fan-out queries are the situation where actually we're not interested in working with the data for user ID 5. We are interested in the average order value for every single user on the system in the past week. Right? Now, because our data is spread out across, you know, potentially a couple of hundred databases, that's actually kind of hard to do. SQL Azure does not have any built-in support for fan-out queries. If you want to do that, you've got to individually go around and touch each and every one of those databases, gather up that data, aggregate it all together. Yes. Was there a good reason to go to something like table storage? One, we were already based on SQL Server, so it made sense to carry it through to SQL Server. Two, there are a bunch of benefits in actually being on a true relational database management system. We would have had significantly more code rewrite if we'd actually moved to table storage than sticking with SQL Server. Table storage is similar. If you want to run an aggregate query on SQL, on Windows Azure Storage table storage, right? An aggregate query is a very expensive operation because it's doing exactly the same thing, right? It's basically going to go across all of your partitions in table storage. So we wouldn't have been getting any particular perf benefit around these fan-out queries. Does that answer your question? Yeah, it's complicated, right? It's complicated, particularly when you're moving an existing application. This stuff is really well suited if you're starting a new application, but it is challenging when you're moving an existing application. Right? So the way we dealt with those fan-out queries is we took a cheap and nasty approach. We basically just came up with our query, and we did a for loop, and we looped through each member database and picked up the data. That is a highly inefficient way to do it. Who can tell me why it's a really bad idea? Because this stuff's network bound, right? We're I/O bound. So it's just crying out for us to do it in a parallel for loop. So come to my session tomorrow and I'll show you how to do it in a parallel for loop. See, that was a little teaser. So multiple databases. We did chop the databases in half. That wasn't necessarily required, but we wanted to show how we could, as we move to the cloud, now support this idea of having multiple brokerages accessing the single exchange service. So, but it does mean you can have multiple federations in a single database. Right? So that means that, you know, say you're in a typical e-commerce database, you could potentially have one federation, so effectively one dimensional scale-out set of databases that deal with your customer data. And another federation, right? So another dimension of scale-out databases that deal with your product lines, right, and so on and so forth. And again, we'll talk a bit more about that tomorrow morning. Quick note on transaction scopes. So you can't use your use transaction while you use your use federation while you're enlisted in a transaction. So because this has sort of evolved over time, it makes extensive use of transaction scopes. That is fine, but again, you can't change the database that you're connected to, because that's effectively what's happening within the scope of the transaction. So you need to make sure that you use the appropriate federation member before you enlist into the transaction. Which sort of brings us onto a little bit more discussion about transactions. So the on-prem version made extensive use of MSMQ, SQL Server transactions, and basically they were all run by the DTC. You don't get any of that stuff, don't get any of that stuff in the cloud, unfortunately. So we effectively had to rip all of that stuff out And we do make much less use of transactions that span across multiple tiers of the application. There's no transactional support across Federation members or across SQL Azure databases at all. So, your transactional atomicity is the scope of a single database. No distributed transactions across multiple SQL Azure databases. I don't know, nothing that I'm aware of, and I would put it into the too hard basket. Transactions are a really hard thing to scale, right? And as soon as we start saying, yes, we're going to support effectively distributed transactions across multiple databases in SQL Azure, we end up with that single choke point once again. So I think it's unlikely that you'll see distributed transactions. But don't quote me on that. I'm not aware of any inside information, but that would be my thought. So, yes. Do you have referential integrity problems? So, in terms of your referential integrity, so if we think about your Federation members, right? So within your Federation members, and we're going to talk about this a bunch more tomorrow, but I will cover it off quickly. So within your Federation member, you've got, say it's an e-commerce database. So you've got, and you've federated out the customer orders. So within that database, you're going to have orders and lines, and those lines are going to reference products, right? So your referential integrity is potentially going to break on products unless you have a copy of all of your products in every database, and that's basically what you do, right? So effectively for data that is sort of read-write at scale, we federate it and shard it. For data that is primarily read-only at scale and where we can tolerate eventual consistency, we duplicate it across every Federation member, so those are our products. And for data that's really only ever touched via a cache, right, we put it in the root database. So we basically put it in the parent database of all the Federation members. So that's the way we get around not breaking our referential integrity. Yeah? If you find that you're breaking referential integrity off your Federation keys, then you've got a problem, right? Your Federation, your sharding database design is wrong. Yeah. So come to the session tomorrow early-ish. I don't know if that's the first session of the day. Feels bloody close to it. We'll deep dive into federations. I promise if you came here thinking, I want to build cross-device bloody mobile applications, we are going to get to that. Who's sitting here going, what the hell did I come into this session for? There we go. I promise you, we will do that. I'll show you some code, and you'll go, holy crap, I can get a huge amount of code reuse using Mono. So decoupling our business service layer from the ordering using the Azure Service Bus. So in the early versions, it was basically a tight coupling. We effectively used MSMQ and directly coupled our brokerage to our stock exchange. That would never happen in the real world, right? Just wouldn't happen. It might happen when you're doing, performance benchmarking applications in Java. It doesn't happen in the real world. So we wanted to try and get a little bit more like the real world. So we basically took what we had, which was effectively, this sort of tightly coupled MSMQ-based channel between our brokerage business service layer and our order processing service, and then our sort of shortcut way of getting the message back to the brokerage service by pushing it through the database, and we said, no, actually, we should do this thing properly. So we did. So obviously, we've split the database in two. The quotes database is the exchange. The accounts database is the brokerage. And then we route this through the brokered messaging capability of the service bus, and we do that by placing our orders out via a queue. So effectively, we drop the order message on a queue, and the exchange picks that up. So in terms of sort of the semantic pattern, not all that dissimilar to the async messaging we had with MSMQ. But then to send the message back, we do something quite clever, and that is that we write the response messages out to a topic, right? And we include on the message an identifier that basically identifies who was the brokerage that sent this, right? We write that back out to the topic, and then our brokerage subscribes to pull the messages off that topic. What that means that we can do is we can then start adding additional brokerages, and those additional brokerages basically all end up with send permissions into the service bus to send a message to the queue. Right? And then they get a listen permission to go and listen to that topic, but we create their subscriptions for them. Right? And we create their subscriptions with some rules, and those rules filter which messages they get back. So it means that in order to add another brokerage, it's really simple. The brokerage just spins up a copy of the brokerage service out of the code. Just go and run it up in Windows Azure. Right? We give it send permission on the queue, configuration only. We give it listen permission on the topic, configuration only. And we set up the rules that ensure that it only receives the messages to which it's entitled to. Right? Basically information about the confirmation of its orders, configuration only. Right? So no code changes to keep adding additional brokerages to this. So a pretty good picture of what we'd think of as a loosely coupled system. People tend to agree with that? So in terms of how that works, we basically have two contracts. So we have the iOrder processor contract, the iOrder processor response contract, and it really is just plain old WCF. So in terms of what we implement in the BSL and the order processing service, it's just WCF services. Right? WCF client, WCF service, off we go. In terms of hosting it, the order processing service we host explicitly within a worker role, and then the business service layer is just hosted within IIS. So we use this thing called brokered messaging, and brokered messaging is basically a way that we use queues and a thing called topics, and it allows us to do rule-based routing where we can choose to route the messages up in the cloud. Right? So we're really starting to see something like the .NET service bus move to have many of those properties you'd expect to see in sort of a big enterprise ESP. And what we do is we use metadata on the message, so we basically add some metadata into the message and use that metadata to drive all the routing rules that we have. So effectively what we do is on the client side we inject the username, the service bus username of the brokerage that's connecting into the message. The message goes up to the server, the order's placed, we echo that username back, and that means that we can interrogate that username for the purpose of our subscription rules. So we'll basically just have a quick look at that. And again, the reason I'm not showing you a whole heap of code here, you'll see pretty quickly why I'm not showing you a whole heap of code here. So what we have here is basically an endpoint behavior. And it is our message inspector. So basically what we do is as the message leaves the client, we inject that service bus username into the message. And then when it hits the service, we're going to echo that back out in the using the same message inspector as it leaves to go back to our topic. So what that means is when the message hits our topic, it has metadata in it, which is the sender name of the original brokerage that sent that message on the queue. And that means that we can then write rules in the service bus to route that message. So what I've got here is a thing called the Service Bus Explorer. Who's seen this tool before? A couple of people. So in the Service Bus Explorer, we're basically just looking at all of the metadata associated with our Azure Stock Trader Service Bus account. So there you'll see that outbound queue. So that's the order processor request queue. So that's the queue that we are using. We're going to send messages to that queue to get them to the stock exchange, right? And then once the stock exchange has finished processing the order, it's going to send the success response out to this topic called order processor response. Right? And the topic allows subscription. So think of a topic as a little bit like a subscribable queue. Right? And so what I mean by that is that if you're a subscriber on that queue, You effectively get your own copies of all the messages to which you're entitled. Right? So you effectively get to establish your own independent queue underneath the topic. And so you'll see within that, we have two subscriptions. One's for one brokerage, BSL. The other's for another brokerage. And they in turn have some rules. And it's those rules that determine that routing, right? So that we make sure that the messages for orders for BSL user just go back to BSL, and the orders for other BSL user are only routed back to the subscription for other BSL user. Right? And so that means if I want to add another brokerage, it's as simple as creating another subscription under there, creating the appropriate rules, and now I've wired that other brokerage into my service bus. Kind of cool? And again, we ship all the code for this and all the docs and all the explanatory blah blah. And it's not a full ESB yet, right? So don't go throw out TIBCO or anything like that. Right? But it actually does a pretty reasonable job of some of these sort of nice cloud applications where you want to bring some of those sort of enterprise loosely coupled patterns into cloud land and where you're not, you know, just doing everything over JSON. I was meant to get a little laugh there. Who's doing everything over JSON? REST everything. Couple owned up to it. Sorry, I'm like, yeah, in one of my anti-JavaScript moods. Okay, so let's talk about JSON. So service bus for high-volume messaging. So the scenario we've got here is that we wanted to allow basically streaming news, right? So if you think about stockbroking's an interesting sort of scenario. And it's become much more interesting about the last 5 years as you start to really see so much more deal flow flowing through these exchanges. And so, you know, things are faster and faster and faster and faster, and, you know, your quant firms are basically moving their servers. They actually care how close their server is to the exchange. You know, it's just massive and, you know, massive volumes of data. And retail customers are actually starting to get concerned about, you know, how quickly can they get the data, because maybe they're running some of their own automated trading platforms. So we wanted to think about how can we deal with some of this sort of high-volume messaging. And so I picked up streaming news as sort of the concept that we'd try and deal with here, and thinking about how would we scale out to thousands, hundreds of thousands of clients. And the approach that you typically take there is, you know, those clients would be polling a web service, probably a RESTful web service, on your web server to pick up their new news. Right? People, who's implemented a pattern like that? Am I the only one? Yeah, a couple more. I know it's late in the afternoon, folks, but feel free to get into it. Who's still tweeting to try and win that phone? See, there you go, they're into it. So our goal was really to offload that polling off our web roles, right, and actually push the polling onto the service bus. Now, there are a bunch of other options available, one of which is Windows Azure Mobile Services, which shipped recently. So that gives us some different approaches as well. But we do think this is quite a nice approach for sort of deterministic, large volume messaging out to multiple subscribers. So the way we do this, again, is using that brokered messaging capability. So our stock trader system, and a stock trader system creates a topic out on the service bus, and it's going to send the news messages to that topic. So that means in order to publish a new news item, it has to make a single call out across the network, right? It makes a single call to drop that news item into the news topic. Our clients, what they're going to do is they're going to call a registration service, and the reason we have a registration service, you'll see shortly, is because we need to scale out topics. Right? And that registration service basically creates for it a subscription to that topic. And then we just add more clients, right? So we can add up to 2,000 subscriptions per topic. Now, at some point, we're going to end up with more than 2,000 clients. And at that point in time, what we do is we basically scale out the topics. So we start creating additional topics here. Right, so we'll then create a news underscore one, news underscore two, so on and so forth. So this is the simple way to handle it. If you want to be more sophisticated, what you can actually do is create a multi-level tree. So effectively what you'd do then is you would create a news topic and you would then have subscriptions that effectively subscribe to that and message into another topic, and it's that second level topic to which your clients would subscribe. And you can basically build up a distribution tree using that. So if you want to be sophisticated, that's the way you'd do it. And actually, I think that's probably the way that the Windows Azure mobile services is working. I think they're using that sort of a distribution approach. People familiar with Windows Azure mobile services? A few people. There's been a session on that here this week already. Okay. So I left the best bit till last. So, delivering cross-platform clients to Android, iOS, Windows 8, and Windows Phone. So, cross-platform mobile app dev. Got a pretty broad spectrum of ways you can handle it, right? One is to use HTML5 and basically wrap up your HTML5 app in PhoneGap. And that's a pretty reasonable approach to take. Some challenges there is, one, it doesn't look native. Two, sometimes it doesn't behave native. If you want a great example of how unpleasant an HTML5 experience can be, check out the Facebook app for iPad. It's an HTML5 app. It is rather underwhelming quite a lot of the time.
Didn't they just rewrite that?
They might have just rewritten it. I gave my iPad to my 2-year-old. I still haven't got my Surface, but I haven't, in the expectation and anticipation, given it to my 2-year-old. So I think they must have just rewritten it. I think the reason they rewrote it is because it just wasn't that wonderful as an HTML5 app. Ignore the no app store discovery. That should have been pulled. That used to be a problem for Windows Phone apps. You will have cross-browser issues, so it does take a lot of testing. It gets particularly funky when you start having to test across multiple browser versions in the Android ecosystem, and as far as you can call Android an ecosystem. And if you try and target anything a little bit more funky, like BlackBerry. BlackBerry, if you're going to build PhoneGap apps for BlackBerry, cross-browser testing can become really painful. But that is a very valid option. The other option is native, right? So just go and write the app 3 times. And that's, if you've got lots and lots of money and you're a really big organization, that's actually not a bad approach either, right? You can pull in your own iOS team, Android team, Windows Phone team, get half a dozen to 10 people, and they can be your team for building those apps. You've got 3 different languages, you've got 3 sets of code to maintain. As long as you've got 3 teams, you're good to go. I'm a big fan of Objective-C. Anyone here an iPhone developer? Big fan of Objective-C. You guys .NET as well? No. Yeah? It's kind of like, dude, like I've been using this really nice language for 10 years and you're giving me this crap. You've got to call it a spade a spade, right?
The guy I work with every day, he's starting to get into Objective-C, and every time he does it, he comes back to the next day and he says how great .NET is.
Yeah. We don't know how lucky we are with .NET, right? But now we're all going to Objective-C and JavaScript, it's like. So, Mono lets us work in this awesome thing called .NET, right? Using an awesome language called C#, using an awesome bunch of tools, and actually we use Visual Studio .NET for most of our development. Support for lambdas, support for links, support for delegates, events, all that cool stuff. And then Mono, what Mono is basically a cross-platform implementation of .NET. And then there's a company called Xamarin, and Xamarin build these tools that basically allow you to use Mono to target applications at Android and iOS. So it gives you, they're paid for tools, right? They don't come free into this community like most of Microsoft's tools, with your MSDN subscription, your gold part, and so forth. You are going to have to pony up some cash to buy these tools. I promise you will pay for it in the first month that you own it. So they provide a bunch of managed .NET code wrappers for all of the underlying platform APIs that then know how to, you know, how to deal with a GPS on Android, how to deal with a GPS on iOS and so forth. And you basically, you can still funk out to native code if you want to, so you can still drop out to native code on any of the three platforms. You are writing two different apps here, right? So you're writing an Android app, you're writing an iOS app, and then you're probably reusing a bunch of that code across those two. You're going to reuse a bunch of that code on Windows Phone. You're going to reuse a bunch of that code on your Windows 8 app. You are still building your user interface by hand, or effectively you're still building your user interface using the UI technology that is specific to that platform. Right? So you're going to be building the specific UI for Android, specific UI for iOS, specific one for Windows Phone, specific one for Windows 8. And that's not a bad thing, folks, right? I mean, that means you actually deliver a really good experience on all three devices instead of one sort of half-assed experience that's meant to work well on all of them. I mean, honestly, if you're a .NET person, you need to build an iPhone app. Mono's a great way to just go build an iPhone app, right? You know, you're using a great set of tools, familiar language. The company's called Xamarin. Xamarin. Yeah, it starts with an X. Starts with an X, spell it like it sounds. So we basically set out down this path with a goal of achieving a significant amount of code reuse across all of these platforms, basically to show that you can, you know, you can really get some efficiencies here. So the way we did this is we basically created a shared project, and that shared project is effectively a set of source code files that sit in a single directory, and they're shared across all of the solutions. But what we do is we have a separate CS proj for each solution. So there's a CS proj Windows 8.shared, Windows Phone.shared, iOS.shared, Android.shared. They all point back to the one folder of shared files, right? We edit those shared files in VisualStudio.net because it's a slightly nicer IDE than MonoDevelop, right? But, you know, whichever one floats your boat. And so then each solution for our four platforms is made up of two projects, a platform-specific project and that shared project for that platform. The way we built it is we used effectively an MVVM pattern across all of the different platforms, and that allowed us to share our models, it allowed us to share all of our underlying repository and all of the communications that we wrote up to the server. We think, on reflection, we probably could have shared our view models as well if we'd been sort of clever. We'd probably try and have a crack at doing that the second time around. You know, you've got to decide to what extent do you want to really be a show pony, right? And, you know, and sort of show off how clever you are at being able to write something that gets shared everywhere, but with the potential to tie yourself in knots, versus going, yeah, at some point I'm going to have to write code for each platform separately, and I'll draw the line there. And then, you know, you can use interface polymorphism to basically create an interface in the shared library, do a platform-specific implementation of that interface, and then use instances of that interface within the shared library, all right? So it's quite a cool way of doing it, and I'll actually show you that in the code. So what I've got here is I've got my Windows 8 application. This is stocktrader.windows 8, and it's running. I'll just stop it. And that's the Windows 8 app you saw earlier. Got to reorder my tabs. So, what we've got is, over here in the Solution Explorer, you'll see I've got two projects here. I've got my shared project, right? And so that's basically referencing the same set of source code files as all of the other shared projects. And I've got my platform-specific project. So within that shared project, I've defined this iResource String Provider interface. I chose something nice and simple, so that's just got a simple method that returns a string, pass in a file name, and it just returns an XML string, which is all the resource strings for the application. Right, but you can see that this is the sort of thing that actually probably is platform specific in terms of its implementation. Right? Go find me the resources file. Okay, well, so on each of the different platforms, I probably have to deal with a different way of pulling that out. Right? Some places I might like to pull out of a resource file, some places I might like to go to disk, some places I might like to go to a database, bloody, 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 blah. So we have that iResources string provider. And that's our interface, and then we implement, we basically create our concrete implementation of that interface in our platform-specific project, right? So there's the interface in the shared project. There's the implementation inside the platform-specific project, right? And then here's the class that actually uses this. So the server settings class actually uses that. Right, so it uses an instance of my iResource string provider. And this server setting class is actually in the shared project. Right, so that's my use of interface polymorphism to basically allow me to have platform-specific code used within that shared code. Who's building some apps like this at the moment? Doing stuff like that? It's an interesting way to be able to handle that. And so, if we dive over here into MonoDevelop, you'll see I've got exactly the same thing, right? So I've got my Android platform-specific project. I've got my stocktrader.shared project. And just to show you I'm not bullshitting, because you guys are sitting there going, he's bullshitting, aren't you? Ooh, look at that. What does that tell you? Same source code file, right? Tells you I wasn't bullshitting. So over here, I'll reload from disk. So I've got the same interface, and then I've got the concrete implementation of my Android resource string provider. And again, it's got a very different looking set of code to what you saw for Windows 8, right? But then I can use that concrete implementation, right, all throughout my shared library, right? Because my shared library wants to do a whole lot of stuff with these resource strings. It just needs a concrete implementation specific for that platform to know how to get to them. Awesome. Right. So then we spoke about that idea of the Azure Service Bus and how we're using the Azure Service Bus for our streaming use. All of the client-side stuff for that is done from shared code. I've got a shared code block that does all of the authentication against the Service Bus, all the communications back and forth from the Service Bus across Windows Phone, iOS, Android, Windows 8, and that shared code just raises events. Right, and I can then hook those events. I actually hook those events from the shared code too, and you know they get pushed through my view models into my views. So it's pretty neat. So we're just polling on a timer. The shared code goes through, registers my device. So basically, it auto generates a GUID that's going to be the unique identifier for my device. It writes it to the local device using one of those platform-specific implementations. Right, writes it out to the device. And then it uses that unique identifier to create its subscription. It auths against the service bus using the access control service. Right? And then it passes that token up to the service bus to get the messages for its specific subscription. Once it's pulled the message, it deletes the message from the subscription. I'm going to skip showing you that file because I am getting a little tight on time. So We've run through a whole sort of plethora of both server-side and client-side approaches there. This is all going to be code that we're going to land into your lap in the next couple of weeks, touch wood. Just get it out the door. And it really does show you some interesting approaches that you can use to build large-scale apps out in Windows Azure, including scale out at the data tier, that we're going to benchmark. So it is actually, provably scalable. I've shown you some interesting approaches for using the Azure Service Bus and effectively creating those loosely coupled approaches, you know, to situations where you might have an external party consuming your service. We've talked a bit about the fact that Azure needs more than mere compatibility, right? So you do have to think about, you know, yes, I can lift and shift, but I need to think about how I might scale that data tier and a few other things. And federations do allow you to scale that data tier. Encourage you to come to the federation session tomorrow. We like Mono as an approach to building these cross-platform mobile apps. Right? You know, you have significant opportunities for code reuse across all of these modern mobile platforms using Mono. It really is quite an elegant approach. And I encourage you to grab that code and pick it to bits. It'll show you, you know, at least a good set of starter code to get you humming here. Yes. So the question is Mono still being actively developed? So the answer is yes. So the company basically Xamarin picked up Mono. I won't bore you with the history, but a guy called Miguel de Guisa worked for Novell. Effectively started Mono as sort of a side project in Novell, spun out. Mono has recently taken a bunch of venture capital. Mono is very much alive, kicking, and basically, you know, sprinting and nailing it. So they're a good bunch of guys, got some good technology, and for sort of people like you and I, who have been luxuriating in .NET for the past 10 years, it's a great way to be able to go and build for platforms like Android and iOS that require one to go down level otherwise. AppCelerator. I don't know enough about AppCelerator to be able to comment, unfortunately. Is AppCelerator like one of the HTML toolkits? JavaScript. Yeah, okay. So that's the reason I don't know anything about it, because I'm like on an anti-JavaScript crusade. There are a bunch of other toolkits which are more sort of HTML plus JavaScript oriented approaches. Pardon? Yeah. Okay, it's pure JavaScript. Yeah, I honestly just don't know enough about it. Yeah, sorry. Are there any known limitations? Yes, there will be limitations. The nice thing is that basically, at the end of the day, you can drop out to the native tool set, right? So if you run into a limitation on iOS, you can drop out to Objective-C, write what you need to in Objective-C, wrap it, and then reconsume it from your Mono application. So where there are limitations, you've got an escape hatch. Yeah, so Mono is effectively your cross-platform.NET. And then Xamarin provide a thing called Mono, you know, Mono Touch, Mono Droid, which are your implementations specific for Android and iOS. And what they're going to provide alongside that are some wrapper libraries that expose all of the underlying hardware device functionality out to you as managed .NET libraries to consume. I don't know, you have to go and check. So the question is, to be able to make use of the demo app once it's been released, we're going to need to have licenses for Xamarin. So the answer is no, you really need your Xamarin license to publish the app into the App Store. So you can still use it. There's a free version you can grab for just kicking around, kicking the tires. No comment. So the question was just with the throttle, you're looking at something with the reserved, bloody blah. Yeah, no comment at the moment. Sorry. I don't work for Microsoft, but I still can't comment. I think there's basically a dead letter capability. So the service bus has a dead letter capability that effectively you can expire messages in the queue if it's no longer relevant. So last one. Polling, yes. So we only poll while the app's open, and that's the reason we specifically wanted to show as far as possible, sort of highly deterministic, as near as possible to real-time messaging to the device. So that wasn't really a design consideration for us. For messaging, for sort of more battery-consistent messaging, we're going to aim to use Windows Azure Mobile Services to support push messaging as well. Folks, I'm going to move into the exhibition area and hang out. So I would love to take some more questions because someone's going to kick my ass for running long. Wait, because I've got 57 new tweets that I've got to randomly pick someone to win this Lumia. So before you leave, I want the bloody blah, forget the code, Samuel McLaughlin. Who's giving me, was that you? The bloody, bloody blah, I've been listening to Barmer too much. Well done. Oh, do your evals. Love reading evals. Write me some nice comments. Thanks for coming, too. I'll see you at the party.